If you just beat up everybody you see all the time, it's kind of bad for your character. And that's what the United States has been doing for 300 years.
I can't think of a stronger statement to make to my fellow countrymen than to join the human shields in Iraq.
We're being blackmailed by Turkey and by Egypt and by all the other countries that we're trying to buy into supporting us in this war.
Turkey is coming to the United States and saying, we could potentially be willing to support this war. However, we want to make sure that you pay us off.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, February 19th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Turkey, the country which shares a border with Iraq on the north and would be strategically critical for any U.S. invasion into that country, is holding out for a better aid package from the U.S. 20 to 30 ships carrying supplies for 15,000 U.S. troops are steaming their way towards Turkey, but the agreement allowing them to house troops on Turkey's bases has not yet been secured. Turkey is asking for upwards of $10 billion in aid to compensate Ankara for any losses during a war with Iraq. The White House has offered an aid package that includes $6 billion in grants and U.S. backing for up to $20 billion in loans. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says that's their final offer. Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz is in Amman, Jordan, after having recently spent several weeks in Turkey. We asked him about reports from the region about the deal with Turkey.
Verna, you hear all kinds of reports. You have to remember that the United States knew all along that it would have to pay a lot of money to persuade Turkey's new Islamic government to support this war with Iraq. The first war in 1991, Turkey did support the United States, and over the last 12 years, they've paid very dearly due to the sanctions. Even conservative estimates predict that the Turkish economy has lost more than $40 billion over the last decade. Whole sectors of the economy and the trucking industry and the oil industry have been completely destroyed, and it's no small consequence now that Turkey has a mammoth international debt. So this time, Turkey is coming to the United States and saying, we could potentially be willing to support this war. However, we want to make sure that you pay us off, that you give us the money that we will lose if we support this war. And this government is asking for an especially high price because, as I mentioned, it's an Islamic government. It came in with a gigantic mandate with more than 70% of the seats in parliament just a few months ago in November. And one of their campaign promises was that they would only support a war in Iraq with United Nations seal of approval and, of course, with France and Germany and Russia and China all opposing a UN resolution. This doesn't seem very likely. So they are upping the stakes and putting off a vote in Parliament to authorize the war.
Well, we're hearing today where in Washington, the White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said that the U.S. administration would make no new offers to Turkey. And he added that time was running out for Turkey to decide whether it will accept the offer that's on the table.
I can't speculate, but if Turkey doesn't get what they want, they may indeed say no to the United States. And that would mean that the United States would have to invade only from the south, where they have more than 100,000 troops in Kuwait. And it could make a war more difficult, and it could actually increase quite substantially the number of American casualties. I should mention also that there's another thing that the Turkish government wants, and that is the ability to go in and occupy northern Iraq as part of this operation. The Turkish army has asked the United States to be able to send 120,000 troops into northern Iraq, and they want to march them halfway to Baghdad. And, of course, Turkey is fighting with the Kurdish people who live in both eastern Turkey and northern Iraq for a generation. There are over 30,000 dead Kurds as a result of this confrontation, so the Kurds of northern Iraq are obviously very concerned that the United States will sign off on this.
Well, Turkey's population is overwhelmingly opposed to this war, and yet the new government is considering backing Bush and his war, but for the right price. It seems, what are the dynamics pushing Turkey to allow U.S. troops to use its soil as a base to attack Iraq?
The most recent poll I saw, Verna, showed that 93% of Turkish people oppose taking part in the war with Iraq. But when I was there and I was interviewing people just a few weeks ago, what you find is that the people there, even though they're outraged and even though they're angry about this war, they also are very accepting at the possibility that their government may support the United States, because they recognize that their government is in a very tough position. The United States is holding the purse strings of the Turkish economy, and they know that the Turkish economy is likely to collapse whether or not they support the United States. If George Bush goes to war with or without Turkish support, the Turkish people will suffer, their economy will collapse. And so that's why if you talk to people, they are very much opposed to war. But then if you ask them, what would you do if you were in the government, they say, I would try to strike a deal with the United States for a good price. But if I have something to say to the American people, I would tell the American people to somehow please stop George Bush from doing this war, because only the American people can really stop the war.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, it's been suggested that the U.S. wants to force Iraq to have to defend itself from the north and the south, which is why Turkey is strategically so important, given the border that it shares with Iraq to the north. But Baghdad, the capital, is in the south. Could there be another motive for wanting northern access to Iraq? Where are the oil fields, for example? Where are they located?
The oil fields of Iraq are located in both the north and the south, Smyrna. You have a large number of oil fields near Basra, which is the port on the Persian Gulf. And, of course, everyone knows the Persian Gulf is central in terms of oil. But you also have large oil deposits in the north, in the Kurdish area, which is actually not in the Kurdish independent zone, but is still controlled by Baghdad, in Mosul and Kirkuk. And there are pipelines that run from Mosul and Kirkuk to Turkey right now, and from there they're loaded onto tankers in the Mediterranean and shipped to the United States in Europe. You also have another pipeline from Mosul and Kirkuk that hasn't been working for years, that runs to Haifa in Israel, which could be rebuilt if you had a friendly regime in Baghdad, which you don't have now. And indeed, the Turks, one of the things that they're fighting over is there have been reports that the Turks would be willing to support a war with Iraq if Turkey was guaranteed a 10% stake in this oil. The best estimates about the amount of oil reserves in northern Iraq, which were estimated by British Petroleum, because Britain used to have control over Iraq up until 1958. These oil fields have been estimated by British Petroleum as worth over $10 billion.
Mm. What's your best guess or bet as to whether or not Turkey will end up with an agreement with the U.S.?
It's hard for me to imagine, Verna, the possibility that Turkey will not in some way support the war. You know that the Turkish parliament last week approved United States troops to come to Turkey to upgrade the bases so that U.S. troops could come later. So there's already motion moving forward on the ground. There's a situation taking place to allow for these troops to come. George Bush obviously feels comfortable enough that he will prevail in this situation, that he has already dispatched a large number of troops through the United States, infantrymen that are coming by boat on their way to Turkey. He's banking that by the time they get to this part of the world, the Turkish parliament will have caved in. I was speaking just a few days ago to a gentleman who was in the Turkish parliament, and he was telling me that he expected to be one of the few people to vote against participation when the vote finally came. But you never know. This is a government, as I said, that came to power just in November. They are presenting themselves as a fresh start and an independent party in Turkey. And if they perceive that it will be political suicide to support the United States, there is a possibility that they will go against the war.
Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz speaking with us from Amman, Jordan. President Bush pledged today to work with the UN Security Council to adopt a new resolution authorizing military action against Iraq, but warned that the United States would act outside the international body if it failed to back a tough new mandate. Speaking as the Pentagon ordered the deployment of another 28,000 troops to the Persian Gulf region, Bush said the United States wants to work with our friends and allies, quote unquote, to broaden broaden support for confronting Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. But President Bush made clear that the United States would not be, quote, hamstrung by continued delay at the Security Council, and added that although it would be of help to win approval of another resolution, it, quote, was not necessary as far as I'm concerned. At the United Nations today, Iraq's neighbors, one after another, stated clearly that the weapons inspectors should be allowed to complete their task of verifying that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction, and that any action should be by a coalition of nations, not unilaterally by the United States. One by one, Iraq's neighbors in the region, Iran, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and Egypt, urged the UN Security Council to pursue a peaceful resolution to the crisis, warning that war would have dire consequences for the region. Libya argued that Israel is in violation of several UN resolutions and is guilty of crimes against humanity, while the UN remains silent. The Nigerian ambassador read the first lines of the UN Charter stating, "We the people," and went on to affirm that the peace demonstrations over the weekend clearly showed that the people of the world are opposed to war in Iraq. The Saudi Arabian ambassador, Fawzi Shabaski, called for cooler heads and reason to prevail.
Mr. President, the Security Council faces today a major test in the way it implements its responsibilities in maintaining international peace and security. As the Security Council acts on behalf of all the members of the United Nations, it represents the entire international community, and therefore the Security Council cannot take lightly international objection to war against Iraq as long as there is a possibility to achieve the requirements of international legitimacy by peaceful means. It is more important and urgent for the Security Council to seek peaceful solutions, for it to act for international stability. That will not be obtained except through the maintenance of the security, stability, and territorial integrity of all countries, including Kuwait. Mr. President, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia seeks to spare Iraq and the region war and its destructive consequences. We call for a solution to the Iraqi issue through the United Nations. The solution must be to implement relevant Security Council resolutions while maintaining the integrity and territorial integrity of Iraq, and to avoid its division in any circumstance. Insisting on the naked use of force will weaken the credibility of the United Nations. It will place doubt in the justice and force of international law. It will return human society to a situation of dangerous chaos at a time when the means of force and destruction are available to all, and their use has become possible in the absence of a central authority of the international community and non-abidance with international law. Even if all means available to implement the resolutions of international legitimacy are exhausted and the principle of war is accepted, the extent of military action must be limited. Its objective must not be to punish the brotherly Iraqi people who have suffered for a very long time and through two different wars. And God only knows what a third war would lead to. Mr. President, we support all efforts to destroy WMDs, whether in Iraq or any other states. The call for WMD disarmament in Iraq must be accompanied by a call to destroy all WMDs in Israel, the only country in the Middle East with a stockpile of nuclear and proscribed weapons. It is the only state in the region that refuses to accede to the NPT. It is the only state in the region that refuses to subject its installations to international oversight. The advocates of Israel justify that situation by saying that Israel has not used nuclear or other WMDs in the past. This is a rejected pretext because Israel does indeed perpetrate mass destruction in the Palestinian occupied territories by killing people, by razing homes, by destroying the infrastructure, by a suffocating economic embargo, by sabotaging farms, bulldozing fields, uprooting trees, by assassinating political Palestinian militants, by fettering the freedom of movement of Palestinians, by closing crossing points, by expanding settlements, and by flouting all human rights of the Palestinian people against international humanitarian laws and norms. Israel has been able to use such excessive force while it holds the most destructive of weapons, thanks to unlimited assistance provided it and denied others. Israel does not need to use WMDs, Mr. President, but it does threaten the states and peoples of the region. The issue is not what kind of weapon is being used. The issue is what results from a policy of premeditated destruction aimed at annihilating the Palestinian cause and planting despair in the hearts of Palestinians, as well as intimidating Arabs and Muslims. It has been said that one of the objectives of war against Iraq is to fight terrorism. Fighting terrorism cannot take place by ignoring its most important route in the region, Palestinian occupation, Israeli occupation of Palestinian and Arab lands since 1967. Violence and extremism in the region is not a reason to cease seeking solution to the Palestinian issue. It is because this issue has not been resolved justly and fairly according to international legitimacy and the principle of land against force, for peace, that we have the current situation. Double standards is one of the reasons of extremism and violence in the region. It is a cause for hatred and division among states. Injustice does breed extremism, and oppression does lead to explosion. The worst oppression is indignity and desecration of all that is holy. Colonialism and settlement are the worst forms of injustice, and as long as this continues, how can freedom shine? Is dawn no closer? Mr. President, peace and security are indivisible. Abiding with international legitimacy is a responsibility of all, and no exceptions can be accepted, whatever pretext is being used, whatever fait accompli is being imposed. What we look for, what we want, is the might of right, and not the use of the principle of might is right. Thank you, Mr. President.
Saudi Arabian Ambassador to the UN, Fawzi Shabashki. Breaking developments over the past week have led some to wonder if the Bush administration's war agenda is beginning to unravel. Massive peace protests around the world and in this country as well have put heat on many of Bush's allies in a war against Iraq, and Turkey's delay in signing on to the deal to house U.S. troops on its soil. For some analysis on this matter, we turn to former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck.
In terms of the diplomacy factor and whether or not this war is unraveling before the Bush administration's eyes, there's also the fact that British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who is, of course, the staunchest ally, is taking quite a bit of heat for supporting Bush's war. British reporters are raising the point with him that his ratings have fell through the floor and are presently at a minus 20.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I haven't seen that. But anyway, and then, of course, they had this horrible embarrassment of that secret intelligence report that turned out to be a 12-year-old public doctoral thesis.
That Colin Powell quoted
the
investigation.
Thing that's fascinating here is that there doesn't seem to be any shame involved in any of this. You know, nobody seems to be embarrassed about the repeated revelations that in order to secure Turkey's staunch support, we got to buy them.
Well, yeah, that's the other factor. Now Turkey has said basically that it's almost like a stick-up.
It is. It's called blackmail. See, but we refuse to be blackmailed, as the president has said so many times with respect to North Korea. I have to tell you, I spend a fair bit of time working with and watching the U.S. military. If we decided that we wanted to ensure that North Korea did not pose a nuclear threat, we have ways to do that in a 24-hour period, you know, without an invasion, without trying to take over the country. But we're being blackmailed by Turkey, and by Egypt and by all the other countries that were trying to buy into supporting us in this war.
But now, Ambassador Peck, I mean, you're familiar with the way this game, quote unquote, works. Aren't those the rules of the game? I mean, when Yemen refused to support the U.S. Years ago, all of its aid was snatched. So isn't it about the aid?
Well, yes, and it's also about being on the side of the big guy. I mean, there's a certain tendency to do that on the part of some countries that are seeking to, let's use the expression openly, curry favor. I mean, you know what that happens in the halls of Congress. It's perfectly normal. But you cannot then step up and say they're supporting us because of their deep-seated beliefs. And hey, no, you bought them. Come on, step right up and admit it. You bought them. The tragedy of it all is that there are clearly ways to achieve what appears to be a reasonable objective, making sure that Iraq doesn't pose a serious military threat, without having our troops go out and get themselves shot up and bloodied and lose limbs and lives. I mean, that's the last step. And President Bush keeps saying that. That's the last step. Well, but you haven't taken the first one yet. If our nation can publicly, actively push Pakistan and India to talk, and they share a bloody border, and the Israelis and the Palestinians to talk, and they share a bloody non-border, and Iraq is 7,000 miles from here, why aren't you talking to them? You know, you don't have to intermarry or go to each other's cocktail parties, but you ought to sit down, as we did during the Cold War, to see if you cannot prevent serious problems from coming up, not because we loved and trusted the Russians, but we negotiated all through the times when we knew, with the push of a button, they could blast us off the face of the earth. There was no question about Security Council resolutions. We knew this. In Iraq, we don't know, and you're not going to talk about it, and you're going to risk enormous possible costs without having taken the first basic step. That scares me.
Ambassador, also in terms of strategically, the U.S. is so seeking to have Turkey a part of this equation because they're hoping to have ground troops come in from the north through Turkey and the south through Kuwait. Question, are the oil fields in the north of Iraq?
Oh, yeah. Well, both. Down in the south of Iraq on the border with Kuwait, you have that Trucial zone, which was one of the causes of the invasion of Kuwait, in which both Iraq and Kuwait, you were supposed to split the revenues from the oil fields there. So they're in the south and they're in the north, and the major oil field in Iraq, called the Majnun field, which is, according to my understanding, the largest known untouched oil pool, sits kind of in the center of the country, more or less. Interestingly enough, when you talk about the north, where the Kurds are, I saw an article in the paper repeated a couple of times, and it was said that the United States was going to give Turkey the right to have control in a 15-mile swath inside the borders in the north of Iraq. Now, I don't think that's going to please our Kurdish allies, who have, if you followed any of that part of the world, been, you know, dumped by us a couple of times in living memory. When we've decided we would advance our own interests at their expense. And that isn't going to please the Kurds.
Well, I suppose right now the main goal is to please Turkey, to have access.
I think the main goal is really to please the war hawks. You may have seen that wonderful sign that they carried in San Francisco that said, get the empty warheads out of the White House. Because, you know, I took part in a war game this past March, almost a year ago in Europe, a two-week war game with the U.S. Army in which the game was the invasion of Iraq. And the whole thrust, the entire war and invasion of it came from the south. So that putting the troops in Turkey is supposed, above all else, to force the Iraqis to face in two directions. If we could, we'd come in through Iran as well and make them face in three directions, or Syria, make them face in four.
Well, what about Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia shares that huge border.
There's nothing out there. But, you know, the Saudis are not going to go for this. It's interesting in this entire context to note that the people who live out there, all of those countries, including Iran, which had an eight-year war, and Kuwait, which was invaded, all of them fear vastly more than they fear a militarily toothless, economically prostrate Saddam Hussein, far less than they fear what's going to happen if we go in and knock him off. That's what they're afraid of, the rage, the outrage. the imbalance, the destabilization, the collapse, the implosions, the explosions are repercussions that are going to cost us dear, and not just in the region, I fear, for a long, long time.
It was estimated that between 8 and 11.5 million people around the world protested this war this past weekend alone. 3 million in Rome, 5 million in Spain, 500,000 in New York City alone. Do you think that they have had any sort of influence on this equation?
Well, if you read people who I think have been or are on a release from mental institutions, most of whom write editorials in the Washington Post, those people just don't understand, or else they're communists, you know, or else they're anti-American, or else they're anti-something. And you just tend to dismiss those folks because you don't agree with them. So, yes, it should count, and it counts with people who matter to me, but it doesn't count with the others.
Well, about the fact that it counts with, British Prime Minister Tony Blair is taking a lot of heat.
But we can go without him. The thing that fascinates me, honestly, is that people who share the kinds of thoughts that you and I are expressing do not pick up the phone or get on the website and contact their two senators and their representative to say, hey, I don't think you ought to do this, because that's the way you can make an impact on how the administration will run, is to ensure that your elected representatives, including the president, know that you're in opposition. But most Americans, they say, oh, boy, it's a terrible thing, but they don't do anything.
Well, you're saying the peace advocates don't lobby
there. Well, the peace advocates do, but it's the rest of the folks who share the views of those who march, but who, A, don't march, and, B, don't convey their opinions. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the silent majority, if you will.
The ones that are saying, well, they're going to get their war on anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And mm-hmm. they will if you don't step up, you know, and if you don't make a noise, they don't know you're concerned. And I put this message out when I'm talking to say, hey, whether you're for it or against it, let people know whether you're for it or against it, because that's the way you make a difference in what passes as a participative democracy here. And most folks don't. They say, well, you know, my voice doesn't make any difference. Well, it does if it's added to several million others.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Edward Peck. For several weeks, the U.S. has been under a heightened state of alert on the basis of threats that have proved to be unfounded. Recently, the alert status was lowered from orange, the second highest level, to yellow. Professor Noam Chomsky at the Columbia School of Journalism spoke of how Americans have allowed fear to pervade their lives.
This is an extremely paranoid society. I mean, it's probably the most frightened country in the world. Those of you who come from other places have probably noticed it. People in the United States just live in terror. You know? Not of terror of any specific thing, just terror. You know. So, for example, through the 1980s, every time the Reagan administration wanted to carry out some atrocity, you know, building up the war in Nicaragua or something, they would float some story about Arab terrorists. And the tourist business would immediately collapse in Europe. It became a joke in Europe. Americans were afraid to go to Europe because maybe some Arab would be hiding behind a lamppost trying to kill them. They'd be like 100 times as safe in Paris as New York, but that didn't matter. And this happens all the time. You may remember the tanks around the White House to protect our leader from Libyan hitmen and all this kind of thing. It runs right through places where you live, like gated communities, like where I live. I live in a pretty wealthy suburb of Boston. There's alarms going off all the time. Because people have alarm systems in their house. I mean, you know, about the only crime you ever get there is, you know, I don't know, some kid is trying to steal drugs from somebody. Or maybe there's a lost cat or something. But the alarms are going off all the time. The police pay absolutely no attention to them. We asked once, our house happened, some kid broke in and was looking for drugs in the medicine cabinet. So, you know, told the cops. We said, is there anything we should do? They said, forget it. We know who the kids are. We can't arrest them. They got rich parents. Forget it. And then we asked, well, is there anything we ought to do? And they said, yeah, you can put in a complicated alarm system if you want, with lasers going all over the place things going into the police station. But you're just wasting your money. We don't respond to those things because they're always false alarms. You know? And it would just be a waste of money to go check. Sooner or later, it'll go off and just annoys the neighbors at 3 o'clock in the morning. But everybody's got them. I mean, if you go down the streets, you know, car alarms are shooting off and so on. And people live in gated communities. In fact, the country is turning into a gated country. If the theater missile defense system goes through, The idea is to put a globe over the United States, which would protect it from all those rogues out there who have nothing else in mind except to kill us. This is just a streak in the, I don't know what, national character or something, which probably has roots in history. You know, I think it has roots in the fact it's extremely bad for a country to win all the time. It's bad for a person, you know. If you just beat up everybody you see all the time, it's kind of bad for your character. And that's what the United States has been doing for 300 years. I mean, the last time the country was threatened was the War of 1812. You know, it hadn't been a marginal threat since then. And its history is just extermination and destruction. You know, the native population overseas and so on, they always win. They're way more powerful than anyone else. And the end result is you end up a total coward, you know, afraid everybody's after you.
Noted author and MIT Professor Noam Chomsky speaking at the Columbia School of Journalism. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.